Greetings, my friends, and welcome to The Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. Journalists and historians have a front row seat for much of what happens in the world. Our guest, Sir Harold Evans, is legendary in the world of journalism, and his books, The American Century and They Made America, offer sweeping historical looks at the United States. A renowned editor, Sir Harold was known as Harry before he was knighted by Queen Elizabeth for his reporting on thalidomide. He's convinced that a rich variety of ideas is essential to creating an inviting future. How should we move forward? With courage, he says.
Courage has to begin as an individual thing, just like it had to begin as an individual thing during the civil rights days, or like it has to begin as an individual thing when somebody is anti-Semitic. So everybody has to have the individual courage when somebody says something which is vicious and prejudiced or even wrong. Not necessarily to say you're wrong, but to say, let me understand the reasons.
Sir Harold Evans settled in the U.S. in 1984, having been editor of the Sunday Times of London for 14 years, then of the Times of London. He was founding editor of Condé Nast Traveler, president and publisher of Random House, editorial director and vice chair of U.S. News and World Report, The Atlantic Magazine, Fast Company, and The New York Daily News. Britain's journalists voted Sir Harold the greatest all-time British newspaper editor in 2002. His book, They Made America, inspired the television series of the same name. Bill Russell and I were intrigued by Sir Harold's perspective on the world, on the United States, and on the media in which he has played such a remarkable role. So it was with particular pleasure that we welcomed him to this conversation. Sir Harold Evans, I am intrigued by the brain sciences and how we come to understand more and more about the human animal. Two things in particular as I was looking forward to this conversation. The brain scientists say that the way our brains work, everything comes in, and it is our job, our brain's job, to pick out the things that are most immediate, that we need out of all of this stuff coming in. So we are good at putting boundaries. And they also say that the way our brains work is that we'll pick two or three things, and then we'll generalize from them. So it is both a matter of putting boundaries and exploding boundaries. So as I thought about you coming as one of the world's great editors, I thought, that's what an editor does. Both puts constraints and explodes the boundaries for us. Is that right?
Well, it's very flattering to put it that way. Some of the greatest changes have been brought in our lives by people who transgress boundaries or by mixed disciplines. And I think one of the things, I was reading Jeff Hawkins' book on intelligence, which has just come out. He's the behind the Palm Pilot and so on. And he's arguing that the brain works differently from a computer. And I've not finished the book yet, but one thought occurred to me that actually, one of the reasons some people do dramatic things is that they've disregarded assumptions and disregarded what our memories tell us will happen if we do X. So they do something surprisingly different. So you cannot predict the brain. I don't know. I mean, he's trying to understand it. I can't even understand the way I think.
Franz de Waal, who is a primatologist who's been studying chimpanzees and other primates for 30-something years, says the reason that you can't make that comparison to hardwired computers is because you don't factor in emotion.
Exactly right, emotion. And also the hardwired computers are on, off, on, off. Whereas life is much more subtle than that, and the intuitions or the facial expressions and the emotions. Half the people I've studied, actually, I doubt whether they thought differently in most of their lives or most of their activities, but they must have thought differently in some areas. And it's nothing intimidating like a super intelligence. It's different ways of thinking.
I just got through reading a piece by the Economist, looking at technology and the future of technology, and they're talking about the digitizers and the people that are migrating to the digital, and then they talk about that retrograde group, the analog people. And in some ways, it seems that what you're talking about is precisely that. That there is a continuum. There is not this, you know, this chopped into neat little pieces, on, off, yes, no, black, white. The life, the world we inhabit actually is much more subtle than that.
That's the difference.
And much of that you bring out as you're looking at innovators with They Made America, that you're, as you're looking at lots of ways over 200 years, there is more, that this continuum is a very important part of understanding how you move things, whether it's forward or not, move things.
Yeah. what impressed me is how obvious some things are, and yet we don't see them. I mean, it's so when I came to America in the 50s, and I was overwhelmed by the supermarkets of food, because I'd just come from a country where there was rationing and no food. Anyway.
And that was after the big war, and much of the world was bereft.
Yes, that's right. Well, America was consuming a vast amount of the world's resources, but actually producing most of two-thirds of the world's manufactured goods in the 50s. But it never occurred to me, why not a supermarket for other things? Why not a supermarket for office products, staples? Why not a supermarket for hardware and stuff, Home Depot? And yet, I'm not interested in making a fortune, frankly, but if I'd been interested in making a fortune, I'd be kicking myself all the way up the hill. Everything, you know, Malcolm McLean, as a trucker in North Carolina, 1937, watching bits and pieces loaded on a ship and very impatient because he wants to get on with things, has the idea of putting everything in a box, a container. He doesn't do it for two decades, virtually. But that revolution, everybody's life, again, it's so obvious.
The container shipments.
The container shipping is so obvious. It's as obvious as the 3M Post-it note. Why is it? Now, you're talking about the way people think. What kind of primitive forces are at work that make somebody see things that I certainly don't see and millions of others don't see? What is it? It's maybe analog, maybe that somewhere in the continuum there's a little blip. I don't know. I don't get it. I don't understand why. I can understand a genius more than I can understand the obvious. Now, it's not a genius to create staples or a container ship, and yet in a curious way it is. It's not genius like Beethoven, or it's not genius like Edison, for instance, wrestling with radio circuits.
There are many things that Sir Harold Evans does know, some of which we will learn when we come back in just a moment with the Paula Gordon Show, Bill Russell and I, and I'm sure Sir Harold will invite you to be with us when we come back. Sir Harold Evans is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. He's known in the publishing trade as Harry Evans and got this knighthood for being one of the world's great editors. Bill Russell?
Two things occurred to me as I was going through this. Three things, actually. One is
this
how,
being They Made America.
That's it. Thank you. How often the context, and you were just talking about that, the context around these people you write about were just dead wrong. They told them how stupid they were, how it wouldn't work, and these were the not just walk-around people, these were the experts in the fields in which these people were working, which reminded me of what I think it was Rabbi Harold Kushner introduced me to, the notion that prophets tell the truth, not the future. It also reminds me of Ray Bradbury, who says, the reason I don't read newspapers is because it, you know, tells me about crimes I didn't commit, fires I didn't start, accidents I didn't participate in. It tells me nothing about the future. And part of what is interesting in this is, on the one hand, there is all this information about the challenges, the obstacles, as well as the achievements of these people over 200 years. But it also, at least for me, forced me to look at the current environment and then look forward. How do these lessons that we can see for going back 200 years, how can we turn that around and think about, or at least build a platform for getting our arms around, our ideas around, our heads around the future?
Well, some generalities emerge from looking at 200 years of these people. One is that how hard it is to do what Bill has just asked us to do, because most of the great innovations were not predicted.
Or predictable.
They just didn't occur to us. I mean, I could see things getting smaller and smaller, like the Olympus cameras that go through the body, tiny, tiny. I can see that. But it may be something completely different, which I can't even envisage, and that's the excitement of it. I think we can only draw certain general things from looking at the past as a guide to the future, which is really what you're asking. And one of the things is the danger of assumptions. Even today, I know I'm making assumptions that are wrong. I'm just going ahead and doing something. And half the innovators actually don't challenge their assumptions. For instance, Edwin Armstrong said very well, we all owe our radio today to Edwin Armstrong. It ain't ignorance that causes all the problems in the world. It's knowing things that ain't so. And I've made a few mistakes in the last 3 or 4 months. I've probably made more. And they're all because I assumed something was happening and it wasn't. So I think challenging assumptions.
That's part of this business about the way our brains work, just the all of our brains work, is that we take those two or three things. The sun will come up. I will breathe. The air will be clean. Oops, the air's not clean.
I think this is so important. Jeff Hawkins is making this point so brilliantly there, that we're actually, the brain is acting from memory. So we remember that the sun came up. So we're expecting to come up again. So memory and the brain are telling us to expect things to go on as they were. And that we can understand. And what we can't understand is when the sun doesn't come up and the train doesn't come and the check from the bank doesn't come, because we assumed it would.
And there is, you talk about Ted Turner being complimented that he could see things that were obvious once he named them, but that nobody else could see.
Turner makes this remark, and this is my pseudo-imitation of Ted Turner. If you have an innovative idea, and 97% of the people think it ain't any good, well, maybe it ain't any good, but I went ahead anyway. So why did he go ahead anyway? I asked him. He said, well, I just had this kind of instinct. And people only go ahead, actually, either from that instinct or from some overpowering something else, because to override 97% of the people is very unnerving.
I found Turner heroic, the way you portray him.
I think he's absolutely marvelous. I came to see him in 1982 when I'd been sacked as editor of the Times of London. And I'd been put in charge, laughingly, of creating a 24-hour television news service for Europe. There was no such thing. And when I went to see all the network chiefs in New York, they said to me, why are you going to see that crazy fool? He's on lithium, you know, he's just not going to get anywhere. And so I went to see him, and of course I was overwhelmed by his personalities, by his humour, but also by what CNN was, which seemed to me to be a fantastic idea.
It was only 4 years old then, too.
Yes, and he was regarded with derision. That's an interesting thing. Why do we, in the majority, and I've no doubt I've done the same, and I'm sure you have, why do we feel it necessary to sneer at people who want to try something new? Would you ever do it?
Alas.
I'm sure you do.
I'm sure.
Of course.
I mean, we all do. We all do it. And follow
that thread with Ted Turner.
Well, 97% of the time we're right.
Yes.
But it's that 3% that makes the difference.
Well, and I think, you know, you do what most people don't, particularly in the business press, because everybody gets all excited about new ideas and innovation and change and how you've got to be a change agent and, you know, you've got to turn the organization around or invent new ideas. And you point out, again, what most people don't point out, which is most change is destructive, and most of it fails. Most new ideas are bad ideas, and the real challenge in all this, and this is where, you know, the personal part, the commitment to stick to it. At some point, it looks just terminally stupid when the whole world, including the experts, is arrayed against you, and you persevere in the face of obstacles, in the face of economic trials, and your family falling apart, and the experiments aren't working, and the whole litany of things happen, and yet these people persevere. And that, there's something, as you say, there's something unusual about that, there's something bizarre about that, there's something dangerous about that, both for themselves, but also for the culture.
There is. Well, they get obsessed. I mean, let's take Edison, for instance. He was, as we know, just not the incandescent light bulb, but the whole system, and was so sure he was right that he persevered through 3,000 experiments for the light bulb. However, when Westinghouse comes along with an alternating current,
well, Edison had used DC.
As is DC for Edison. Edison can't see it. So here we have the foremost innovator, probably the foremost genius in an inventive sense we've had, and yet he's got so fixated. The fixation which drove him to overcome what Bill's referred to, the frustrations and failures, is a fixation which keeps him on the wrong track. It's like a railway train going along. And you refuse to go down this, because it leads you to a siding, but the next one leads you a beautiful and pleasant valley, and you still won't go down it. So, perseverance and consistency may yield a trophy, but they can also be delusive.
And yet, just referring back to Turner, the last race he runs is just a catastrophic storm in a boat he calls Tenacious, which I think is interesting. And he says of himself that when he was young, his heroes were Alexander the Great and some other general, and he was self-critical to say he grew up to have heroes who were Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., that he had gone from being a man of war to a man of peace. So this tenacity is there, and yet there is fluidity in that as well. So it's not like these guys are just obsessed. They've also got some movement in there.
Turner developed. I think it's here we have somebody who was reactionary,
politically,
arrogant, and turns into giving $1 billion to the United Nations, who, while the politicians are still arguing, recognizes the dangers of global warming and is prepared to do something about it, who's shown he can shed convictions which were really... Convictions are very often prejudices on stilts, you know. and these were heartfelt, and I think he thought his way to a new realization. I think travel is a big, great thing. And very interesting thing, there's a lot of sneering about people who live on coastlines. Actually, a curious thing is that seaports have always been traditionally the home of new ideas coming in from the sea. So I like to think take some consolation from that.
You'll remember who this was. Somebody said that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. Thank you. And the trick in that, I mean, it's transparently obvious when you think about it, except the trick in that is, of course, distinguishing between foolish and not foolish. And that seems to be the challenge in this. And, with all these examples, and I think it's what you're saying, there's no hard and fast rule for distinguishing between consistency and foolish consistency.
No, I agree. I think with Turner and with a few others like Charles Goodyear, vulcanizing rubber, I think there's a gut feeling which overrides all the logical objections and overrides all the reasonable objections, you know, to this kind of thing. There's something, I've got to do it, I must do it. When I say it can lead you astray occasionally, and I can't do the arithmetic, I don't think Allah the Almighty can do the arithmetic of whether you should follow these obsessions or not. But if you think about if the people who have followed them, riding through all those uncertainties, have given us so many benefits. I'm thinking of Raymond Damadian. His grant is cut off, he's a doctor. His phones are cut off. Why? Because he's trying to invent an MRI machine. So everybody else is sure he's crazy, just as they're sure Ted Turner was crazy. There must be some inner gut. I'm going to tell you a comic story about him. Well, when I wrote a chapter in my book about him inventing the image of a human body, first pictures inside of it, later perfected by other people, I described him in the book as paranoid, abrasive, aggressive, excitable. And he sent the chapter back with some technical corrections, but he left that standing. So I felt like saying, and with a well-developed sense of humility.
This is Sir Harold Evans, who has his own well-developed sense of humility. He has done many things. We'll talk about many of them when we come back in a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. We hope you'll be with us. We're back with the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be in the company of Sir Harold Evans, known in the publishing trade as Harry Evans. Before I forget, you said in a very passing way you were sacked at the Times, and yet that is one of the reasons that you've been able to do so many things. Isn't this ability to rise from what looks like a terrible event at one point of your life to then say, okay, well, I got knocked down on that and get up and do the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. You wouldn't be Sir Harold Evans had you not been fired from the Times.
Oh, it was a benefit which came very well disguised at the time.
Well, and isn't that part of what you're telling me in the monumental book, They Made America, and in the TV as well?
Well, I tell you, well, I probably would have still been knighted because I got it mainly for the journalism I'd done, which was based campaigning for thalidomide children, getting compensation for people who were deformed by a negligent drug company. I got that for rather than for anything since I came to the United States. But actually, I've loved coming to the United States, and unless I'd been fired, this is where the benefit loses its disguise or attains its disguise. Unless I'd been fired, I wouldn't be in the United States sitting in this room in Atlanta with you. I wouldn't have, my wife wouldn't have edited Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. I wouldn't have been president of Random House. Oh, a whole catalogue of ifs, and I'm actually glad it happened.
Exactly.
I also feel better. I mean, technically I resigned. Accurately, I was sacked, but I could have made a fight of it. I'm glad I didn't, for the reasons I described in my book, Good Times, Bad Times, that there comes some times when I might have been prepared to make compromises to preserve myself that would have shamed me.
And that puts you in league with the kind of people of whom you're talking when you're talking about innovation. There is something, I think it is the Buddha who Joseph Campbell says had three don'ts. One should eschew, I love the word, one should eschew
lust,
fear, and social conformity.
I find it hard to forgo the first.
Well, be that as it may, that's what Joseph Campbell said, okay. The Buddha said. But this business about social conformity, yeah. I don't think
that's
think
why,
about
that's why
that.
Buddhism is, as many other religions,
no, I admire the Buddhists a tremendous amount, and it's horrible when they're persecuted around the world, as they are, for a peaceful, wonderful people, and a wonderful religion, too.
And isn't this notion that we should eschew social conformity one that is hard to get your hands around?
Well,
sometimes.
It is, because some social conformity is very necessary. You know, we expect people to behave reasonably and not become violent. We expect people to honor their neighbors and love their wives. That's all social conformity. Depends what your moral values are. What my guiding thing in moral values is, I'd like to think that the moral values I have don't consist of imposing my will on other people. And so when we have election talk about this, that, and the other, I think it's important to remember that moral values are not a single commodity like something in a supermarket. I think the essence of it is as Kant said it, the true ethics is to treat everybody as you wish to be treated yourself. The moral imperative, and that's what I like to think of, is the true moral value. Talking about failure, it is true to say that most of the people in They Made America have been failures. Fail time and time again. And, I mean, Edison made the incandescent light bulb 3,000 times before it worked. Henry Ford said, I keep trying to do the impossible. Pierre Omidyar with eBay, and Herbert Boyer with trying to create artificial insulin. It kept failing. They're trying to clone a gene. And I think it's amazing that people keep going. So they're not keeping lust and social conformity don't come into those things. Why do people go on? I think there's partly vanity. We don't like to be defeated. We'd like to solve a problem. Also, I think altruism comes into many innovators. And I'm very, very impressed by the number of people who actually give the lie to the idea that all people are consumed by greed. You know, there's Giannini who invented banking for popular people. He said, no man owns a fortune, it owns him. And Sam Colt, whose gift to the world is somewhat arguable, the six-gun revolver, he said, money is trash. And I find this is a moral thing to debate. And I'm not, I will be denounced for some kind of Panglossian. but honestly, let me just put this proposition to you.
Excuse me.
I mean, just tell me whether you think there's something in it. The people I've written about over 200 years who've been guided by some altruistic or intellectual curiosity rather than making money made fewer mistakes than those who went simply for money, because if you go simply for money, you're likely to end up in a scandal.
I was struck by how often in your telling, and obviously your perspective may be part of that, but how often you are able to quote these people saying something negative about money, or that it was not the driver, that it was something else, that it was, you know, and almost inevitably it was solving a problem. It was seeing a problem that other people, problem or opportunity, but frequently a problem, and then doing essentially whatever was necessary to solve that problem.
Exactly. If your objective is to make money, if that's just the simple objective, and I'm not going to decry making money, we all need to survive, etc. then you're prepared to cut corners, because that's the only guideline. It's making money. If, on the other hand, you're trying to solve an intellectual problem, you know it's useless to cut the corner in an intellectual problem. Or if you want to benefit mankind, there's no point in doing something which aggravates pollution or whatever it may be.
I'm trying to answer your question as you are directing it. It seemed to me time and again that the people that, and maybe this is because it was you writing and editing, they made America, that many of these people were driven not by money but by a sense of they could create something new in the democratic tradition. And it seemed that that was a theme. Now, again, it may be because you picked them and you were drawn to them, but that seemed also to be an imperative in this search for what is it about innovation.
Oh, I think there's no question in my mind that some of them were distinctly motivated by a democratic sense. Let's just take for a second Giannini. Travelling in his mother's womb on the first transcontinental railway, arrives in San Francisco.
Really, truly, this isn't metaphorically.
He was a fetus. And he's born in California. His father's murdered. His mother goes, sells fruit and vegetable, and he helps. So he's coming from hardship and difficulty. When he marries somebody and he finally gets a seat on a tiny bank, a board director, tiny bank, and their policy is to lend money to people who don't need it, i.e. the rich, and not to give it to people who do need it, i.e. the poor who want a mortgage. And it's a marvellous moment when somebody comes in who's expecting a baby and they want a loan of $100, which the banks wouldn't normally give, it's too small, and he gives it. He says, I'm investing in the future. He wanted to popularize banking out of a democratic instinct coming from his own experience, because he'd seen what it was like to be a little person, and he forever after was on the side of the little man. That is a genuine democratic impulse. I think Henry Ford, before he went crazy and nasty in his old age, was inspired by Emerson. When he read the passage, it's interesting, his copy of Emerson, which he kept all the time.
That will be Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Ralph Waldo Emerson. He's marked where he says, if you don't give back, you're corrupted by worms. And that's at the time he was reading that, when he decided to give $5 a day to the workers, because he'd also seen how assembly line was really making automatons of them. And so he gave back and was, of course, denounced by the Wall Street Journal for a criminal activity. And Salzburg on the New York Times said, this man is utterly dangerous to society. Because so the democratic impulse was there in Ford when he did the Model T as well, of course, previous to that, because he could have made more money initially by continuing to build what became the Cadillac motor car rather than the Model T Ford. Now, it's obviously, it gives me a good feeling to think this is true, but I think there's evidence for it.
This is Sir Harold Evans, and so I don't have to interrupt Bill Russell. I will take us to a break. We'll all be back in just a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. We invite you to be with us, too. Sir Harold Evans is with us, Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon, here on The Paula Gordon Show. He has written They Made America, as well as The American Century, is widely known as one of the world's great editors and has had a distinguished career on many fronts. We talked about Kildall as we went away. It happened that when your book, They Made America, came in, I was reading Who Built America?, which is sort of a companion piece, because it looks at working people what has been known as the new social history. So it was interesting to be watching these things together, which really does bring us to Kildall. There's more to the story.
This is your story, and I am deeply appreciative to see it.
The name is Gary Kildall.
I thought I knew something about the computer industry, and this is a story that I'd simply not heard
before.
Well,
this is a story everybody should read, actually.
If Can you
only
tell
to,
it to
honor,
us in
the,
brief?
Honor the memory of the man who gave us so much, the basis of all software in the United States and around the world, the software industry was created by Gary Kildall. He was a California young man. He was the Mozart of code writing. Somebody else is the Salieri in this story, but this man is the Mozart of code. And he devises an operating system for the PC, which makes software compatible with any hardware. That was a fantastic revolution.
This PC being the personal computer, and this is a story that none of us seem to know.
Well, the personal computer was, let's just go back a bit. So there he has devised an operating system for a computer, and IBM is about to launch a personal computer, and they need to find an operating system. Now, Kildall's operating system has been pirated by people all over the place, and he's to go around and debug it, their machine, and up would come up. This is the copyright of Digital Research, which was Kildall's company, so they would shamefacedly start paying the license fee. He never sued them. He was a tremendous idealist. He didn't believe in suing. He believed in loving. He also believed that anybody who invented an operating system should not own application system because, as he said, it would be a dangerous monopoly.
This being an open systems approach.
Right, exactly. It's open and it's free. It's what we're talking about secrecy. So IBM want to have a personal computer, a great initiative of theirs. They go to Bill Gates at Microsoft, and he has to say he doesn't have an operating system. He refers them to Kildall. They fly down to Kildall. Kildall sees him in the afternoon. He signs the non-disclosure operating agreement with them, and they start discussing terms. Okay, then they fly back. They don't like his terms, and they go to Bill Gates, and Bill Gates does something which Gary Kildall said he would not do. Gary said, "Bill won't stab me in the back." So Bill Gates buys one of these, how can I put it politely, one of these adjusted operating systems of Kildall with all the many of the same features, and sells it to IBM. IBM put out a notice of how they're preparing for the personal PC, and in it they include the things that software operators need to know. Kildall and everybody in the business suddenly recognize this is Kildall's system. So Kildall and Tom Rolander, his associate, fly to Boca Raton and say, "Hey, wait a minute, what are you playing at? This is our operating system."
And it clearly was.
So IBM say to him, "Well, look, for God's sake, don't sue us. We're completely stymied if you sue us. Why don't we put out your system with the thing, MS-DOS from Bill Gates? We know that your system's superior, but put them both out and then the marketplace will win." Gary Kildall says, "Fine, I know it'll win because I'm working on superior systems even more so." They go away. They don't sue. When IBM puts out the PC, they do something which they said they were not able to do, not entitled. They outprice Gary Kildall's system, charging it more than $200, whereas the Bill Gates system is under $40. But this was something which Gary Kildall's lawyer had foreseen, and he said, "You must promise to market them at the same price." And IBM said, "We can't, it would be illegal." So what they did was to just totally do something outrageous, and it remains outrageous to this day. And the story's, you know, worth telling, and I've tried to get an answer from Microsoft and Bill Gates about it, who told a Business Week that it was inaccurate, and I'm waiting to hear, because I will correct the inaccuracies, but as it stands at the moment, I have to say that enormous injustice was done to Gary Kildall. Not only that, this version of his system that got into the mainstream of computer operations was defective, so we had more crashes than we needed to have had. We were held back. Now, Kildall's dead. I was lucky.
Maybe of a broken heart as well as having taken a fall.
Well, he got very bitter, but he fell and banged his head, and they didn't diagnose the clot in the head, and so he died of that at the age of 54. The thing which my story of Kildall is based, he wrote on a memoir which his family kept, and I went and I said, "If you let me draw on it, I will check it out with various interviews," which we did. I will be responsible for publication, not you, because they were slightly worried about it. But anyway, I had it legally checked, and it was checked out, and it also checked out in all the factual cross-checks, so we published it. And I think, actually, Bill Gates should now do the honourable thing, because he was a very visionary businessman. He actually created, saw the potential of this IBM personal computer more than Kildall did, to be truthful. So it's time to honour the memory of the man who created it, and I'd like to see him do that.
I can't let this hour pass without trying to put together, or asking you to help us put together, your experience in the media, particularly in journalism, with the kinds of technological changes that you write about. And it seems that in some very real ways we're on one of those cusps now where the technology and the subject, journalism, have come together in some very interesting ways. And another theme that we've talked about, which is the economic drivers, the huge economic forces that determine a great deal of what we know about the world around us. And, you know, on the basis of your experience and on the basis of your research and your thinking about this book, remembering that prophets tell the truth, not the future, do you have a sense of what we can expect from the media, what we can expect from journalism, a sense of the flow, the direction that will hopefully bail us out of what is a not particularly, I think, vibrant media now?
Well, it's not a vibrant media because there's been far too much concentration. And one of the troubles with the current state of technology and the current state of business, really, is that the powers tend to concentrate at the center. This is a very bad thing because pluralism is the name of the game. And the more plural outlets and sources we have, the better. The fewer we have, however brilliant a person, however even well-meaning a person who concentrates communication, it's not a good thing at all, because it's remember the great scene in the House of Commons when Neville Chamberlain, when he's still Prime Minister, he said, "Methinks in the bowels of Christ you could be wrong." You know, well, that's true. So I think that it's really dangerous situation in American... I've always admired American freedom of communication. I've invited the Freedom of Information Act. I'm really alarmed at the way now attempts are being made to force journalists to reveal their sources. And many the media is unpopular for a number of reasons. Partly there's too much pornography and certain cable channels and whatever. And nonetheless, a great deal will be lost if journalists cannot rely on confidential sources. We won't know what the hell's going on in the secrecies of government. We have a government which is pretty secretive at the moment. It's natural tendency of governments to be secretive. So technology, as Bill suggests, and the forces of capital accretion are tending to put a tight band around free expression and the free exchange of ideas. And the media, too, has many responsibilities. Far too much in the media, to me, and I speak as a newspaper editor, I sound like a gamekeeper turned poacher. I read far too many stories that are not substantiated, far too many unsourced stories, far too much bias in headlines. I thought that the It was particularly true in the 2000 Gore election, where Gore was accused of saying things which became a parody of actually what he'd said. But erasing that fixed notion proved to be impossible. So everybody goes around saying Gore claims he invented the internet. He never said anything of the kind. So it is a worrying time, and the only solution I can see to it is to resist concentration. Do not let any more concentration happen in radio, in newspapers, to resist attempts to throttle journalists, even though they may be unpopular. And I think for the good to drive out the bad. There is bad, but the good to drive out the bad.
And we will rely on people like Sir Harold Evans to do that. We'll be back in a minute for a couple more minutes with him. Please be with us when we return with the Paula Gordon Show. Sir Harold Evans is with us, Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon, here on The Paula Gordon Show. He has written They Made America, as well as The American Century, is widely known as one of the world's great editors and has had a distinguished career on many fronts. We talked about Kildall as we went away. It happened that when your book, They Made America, came in, I was reading Who Built America?, which is sort of a companion piece because it looks at working people and
yeah,
what,
a good book.
What has been known as the new social history. So it was interesting to be watching these things together, which really does bring us to Kildall. There's more to the story.
This is your story, and I am deeply appreciative to see it.
The name is Gary Kildall.
I thought I knew something about the computer industry, and this is a story that I'd simply not heard before.
Well, this is a story everybody should read, actually. If
can you tell it to us in
the,
brief?
Honor the memory of the man who gave us so much. The basis of all software in the United States and around the world. The software industry was created by Gary Kildall. He was a California young man. He was the Mozart of code writing. Somebody else is the Salieri in this story, but this man is the Mozart of code. And he devises an operating system for the PC, which makes software compatible with any hardware. That was a fantastic revolution.
This PC being the personal computer, and this is a story that none of us seem to know.
Well, the personal computer was, let's just go back a bit. So there he has devised an operating system for a computer, and IBM is about to launch a personal computer, and they need to find an operating system. Now, Kildall's operating system has been pirated by people all over the place, and he used to go around and debug it, their machine, and up would come up. This is the copyright of Digital Research, which was Kildall's company, so they would shamefacedly start paying the license fee. He never sued them. He was a tremendous idealist. He didn't believe in suing. He believed in loving. He also believed that anybody who invented an operating system should not own application system because, as he said, it would be a dangerous monopoly.
This being an open systems approach.
Right, exactly. It's open and it's free. It's what we were talking about secrecy. So IBM want to have a personal computer, a great initiative of theirs. They go to Bill Gates at Microsoft, and he has to say he doesn't have an operating system. He refers them to Kildall. They fly down to Kildall. Kildall sees him in the afternoon. He signs the non-disclosure operating agreement with them, and they start discussing terms. Okay, then they fly back, they don't like his terms, and they go to Bill Gates, and Bill Gates does something which Gary Kildall said he would not do. Gary said, Bill won't stab me in the back. So Bill Gates buys one of these, how can I put it politely, one of these adjusted operating systems of Kildall with all the many of the same features, and sells it to IBM. IBM put out a notice of how they're preparing for the personal PC, and in it they include the things that software operators need to know. Kildall and everybody in the business suddenly recognise this is Kildall's system. So Kildall and Tom Rolander, his associate, fly to Boca Raton and say, hey, wait a minute, what are you playing at? This is our operating system.
And it clearly was.
So IBM say to him, well, look, for God's sake, don't sue us. We completely stymied if you sue us. Why don't we put out your system with the thing MS-DOS from Bill Gates? We know that your system's superior. But put them both out, and then the marketplace will win. Gary Kildall says, fine, I know it'll win because I'm working on superior systems even more so. They go away. They don't sue. When IBM puts out the PC, they do something which they said they were not able to do, not entitled. They outprice Gary Kildall's system, charging it more than $200, whereas the Bill Gates system is under $40.
This is
and
not
so
fair.
But this was something which Gary Kildall's lawyer had foreseen, and he said, you must promise to market them at the same price. And IBM said, we can't, it would be illegal. So what they did was to just totally do something outrageous, and it remains outrageous to this day. And the story's, you know, worth telling, and I've tried to get an answer from Microsoft and Bill Gates about it, who told A Business Week that it was inaccurate, and I'm waiting to hear, because I will correct the inaccuracies, but as it stands at the moment, I have to say that enormous injustice was done to Gary Kildall. Not only that, this version of his system that got into the mainstream of computer operations was defective, so we had more crashes than we needed to have had. We were held back. Now, Kildall's dead. I was lucky.
Maybe of a broken heart as well as having taken a fall.
Well, he got very bitter, but he fell and banged his head, and they didn't diagnose the clot in the head, and so he died of that at the age of 54. The thing which my story of Kildall is based, he wrote on a memoir which his family kept, and I went and I said, if you let me draw on it, I will check it out with various interviews, which we did. I will be responsible for publication, not you, because they were slightly worried about it. But anyway, I had it legally checked, and it was checked out, and it also checked out in all the factual cross-checks, so we published it. And I think, actually, Bill Gates should now do the honourable thing, because he's a very visionary businessman. He actually created, saw the potential of this IBM personal computer more than Kildall did, to be truthful. So it's time to honour the memory of the man who created it, and I'd like to see him do that.
I can't let this hour pass without trying to put together, or asking you to help us put together, your experience in the media, particularly in journalism, with the you know, the kinds of technological changes that you write about. And it seems that in some very real ways we're on one of those cusps now where the technology and the subject, journalism, have come together in some very interesting ways. And another theme that we've talked about, which is the economic drivers, the huge economic forces that determine a great deal of what we know about the world around us. And, you know, on the basis of your experience and on the basis of your research and your thinking about this book, remembering that prophets tell the truth, not the future, do you have a sense of what we can expect from the media, what we can expect from journalism, a sense of the flow, the direction that will hopefully bail us out of what is a not particularly, I think, vibrant media now?
Well, it's not a vibrant media because there's been far too much concentration. And one of the troubles with the current state of technology and the current state of business, really, is that the powers tended to concentrate at the center. This is a very bad thing because pluralism is the name of the game, and the more plural outlets and sources we have, the better. The fewer we have, however brilliant a person, however even well-meaning a person who concentrates communication, it's not a good thing at all, because it's made with the great scene in the House of Commons when Neville Chamberlain, when he's still Prime Minister, he said, "Methinks in the bowels of Christ you could be wrong." You know, well, that's true. So I think that it's a really dangerous situation in American. I've always admired American freedom of communication. I've admired the Freedom of Information Act. I'm really alarmed at the way now attempts are being made to force journalists to reveal their sources. And many the media is unpopular for a number of reasons. Partly there's too much pornography and certain cable channels and whatever. And nonetheless, a great deal will be lost if journalists cannot rely on confidential sources. We won't know what the hell's going on in the secrecies of government. We have a government which is pretty secretive at the moment. It's natural tendency of governments to be secretive. So technology, as Bill suggests, and the forces of capital accretion are tending to put a tight band around free expression and the free exchange of ideas. And the media, too, has many responsibilities. Far too much in the media, to me, and I speak as a newspaper editor, I sound like a gamekeeper turned poacher. I read far too many stories that are not substantiated, far too many unsourced stories, far too much bias in headlines. I thought that the It was particularly true in the 2000 Gore election, where Gore was accused of saying things which became a parody of actually what he'd said. But erasing that fixed notion proved to be impossible. So everybody goes around saying Gore claims he invented the internet. He never said anything of the kind. So it is a worrying time, and the only solution I can see to it is to resist concentration. Do not let any more concentration happen in radio, in newspapers, to resist attempts to throttle journalists, even though they may be unpopular. And I think for the good to drive out the bad. Well, there is bad, but the good to drive out the bad.
And we will rely on people like Sir Harold Evans to do that. We'll be back in a minute for a couple more minutes with him. Please be with us when we return with the Paula Gordon Show. Sir Harold Evans is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula. Bill Russell and I are delighted by this opportunity. If you would please, let's talk a little bit about this wealth that you have encountered in your professional life. The fact that you did exercise this same sense of winnowing, if you will, that as a publisher, as the head of Random House, as an editor, you've been in a position to help us know what we need to know. And it's really a continuation of what you were talking about a moment ago with Bill, in terms of we need more, not less, that pluralism is good. Being part of the great stew of ideas, how do we continue to protect these ideas to make sure that whatever comes next, whatever, is to the good, rather than yielding to the forces of darkness, if you will?
Well, I tell you, I think courage has to begin as an individual thing, just like it had to begin as an individual thing during the civil rights days, or like it has to begin as an individual thing when somebody is anti-Semitic. So everybody has to have the individual courage when somebody says something which is vicious and prejudiced or even wrong. Not necessarily to say you're wrong, but to say, let me understand the reasons. Because I think that the personal collision of prejudice against rationality and all that can be tremendously helpful. I think that we should maintain, if we can, pressure to enhance education. I mean, I wish history were taught rather better than it is. I wish this kind of history that I'm talking about here. Because while on the one hand, I'm against exploitation, I don't like the idea to get around, which some university students have, that all business is exploitive and therefore we should wreck it, bring it down. And so that's important to me. So I think that the... I think we should praise honourable men.
And women.
Let me finish the sentence. We should praise honourable men and even honourable women.
Thank you for that.
It seems that the editorial voice, and that's a large part of this whole story, is the patterns that emerged, that people see, people in the characters in your book, your books, that they are able to see patterns that other people can't see. And it seems that that's part of what an editor, and particularly in the news environment, in the journalism environment, that the editorial function is not to defer to power, not to defer to money or wealth or the owners or any of those things, but to do the best job possible of presenting the world as it is.
That's very, you know, I tell you, I have a real, you've got my King Charles's head here, which is an expression I trust you know. But the thing is this, that newspaper editors and publishers and writers of any kind who think they're serving us by saying, on the one hand and on the other hand, too much journalism is less in search of truth than the utterance of two competing public relations organizations. That's no good to us. We've got to have integrity in the news, but we've also got to reinforce curiosity with energy so that we get closer to the truth. Now, you can't get the whole truth every time, but you try. Whereas if you on the one hand say Jesus Christ was a very difficult fellow, on the other hand he didn't deserve to be crucified. Do you know what I mean? On the one, throughout political reporting, you get things like Kerry's disputed war record, take the last election. There shouldn't have been any dispute about Kerry's war record, let's be frank about it. I mean, there was a lot of propaganda. And to say, on the one hand, these veterans say he was a coward, he didn't shed any blood, it's a total monstrous and obscene lie, and it should be said as such. And you can't advance truth and understanding. You certainly have to acknowledge that assertion, but you have to say it's like, but you don't have to repeat it ad nauseum on news shows and television as though it's actually something which is an established truth. Ditto with other politicians, whether it be left or Democrat or Republican or whatever. So I think the notion of objectivity has to be redefined. Objectivity shouldn't be confused with, on the one hand, on the other hand, impartiality. It should be a reverence for truth.
And Sir Harold Evans has that reverence, which he has exhibited in a world full and a lifetime of activities. We are just thrilled that you have been with us. Thank you so very much.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much.
They Made America is an engaging companion to Sir Harold Evans' bestseller, The American Century. We particularly appreciate Sir Harold bringing to light the story of Gary Kildall and his pivotal role in the personal computer revolution. We also thank Sir Harold for his wonderful curiosity and for his commitment to courage. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.